Hello everybody, it's George from Ireland. Well, thanks for coming back to my channel. And this video, I'm saying Clive of India statue must stay where it is, outside the United Kingdom's Office for Commonwealth, sorry, Foreign Commonwealth and Development Affairs. Because Baroness Thangam Debonair recently made an intervention as saying that it ought to be removed. It somehow impairs Indo-British relations. Now, Miss Debonair had the ignominy of, I think, being the only Labour MP to lose a seat last year. In a year where Labour made massive strides, she lost. Well, how opprobrious. It so happened that I bumped into her by London Bridge a days later. I said, "Excuse me, are you Thangam Debonair?" She said, "Yeah, I am." I said, "Loser, you lost your seat." And she said, and as I strode, she said, "You're a fucking cunt, aren't you?" Oh, I really got her. Felt good. Okay. But that aside, with crime rates going through the roof, with illegal immigration shooting up, with the NHS waiting list getting even longer, with the strikes about to start in the National Health Service, with taxes going up, with inflation going up, with all sorts of problems the United Kingdom was facing with the threat from Russia, you might think there were more pressing concerns for the Labour government. I mean, fortunately, at least the Labour cabinet doesn't seem to suggest they're going to go along with what La Debonair has to say. Now, Clive of India, in case you don't know, he's best known for his work in the Honourable East India Company. I know some people think it's dishonourable, but that was its name for a while, which was founded on the 31st of December 1600 with a charter from Queen Elizabeth I trading under the East Indies. In fact, the first voyage to what we now call Indonesia started then in Surat, that's in Gujarat, so the west coast of what's now the Republic of India, and really just trading, just purchasing items, shipping them back to England or Wales, and selling them, and selling items from England or Wales to what's now called India, but they also traded what's now Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Pakistan, eventually Malaysia, Singapore, China even. And now Scotland then joined when the United Kingdom was formed 1707. Ireland, even though we weren't even part of the UK till 1801, some of our men, they were working for the East India Company. So that was just trading. And obviously, India in the 17th century, under the rule of the Mughals, these Muslim Persian-speaking people of distant Mongol ancestry who'd invaded. So India was already ruled by invaders at the time and just setting up trading posts. And that was it. Had their own armed men to protect their trading posts wherever they had their valuables, their cash or whatever their goods were for sale. And it then got into to land later on. It was not founded with any intention of controlling any land, of acquiring it by purchase or by force. As John Robert Seeley, that professor of history at Oxford University, said in the late 19th century, the British Empire was acquired in a fit of absence of mind. There was no grand scheme. It occurred in a haphazard fashion. But so Robert Clive, son of a not very successful solicitor from Market Drayton in Shropshire, then he was signed up, I think, age 17, as a writer, as a clerk in the East India Company, sailed there, was stuck in Brazil for a while when they were becalmed in the doldrums, because the voyage to India took roughly 8 months, but then distinguished himself not so much in his clerical duties, but with his valour when it came to fighting. Remember, France had Compagnie des Indes, which was there under Dupleix. So he's a contentious figure. He was Governor General of British India. Remember, then the East India Company began purchasing land. So rather than buy the things, indigo or whatever, or opium or things, we'll just purchase the land and farm it ourselves and hire the labourers or whatever, eventually getting this Diwani from the Mughal Emperor, as in the right to govern Bengal. That's modern West Bengal plus Bangladesh, eventually Orissa, other states, and be tax farmers and tax people, pay whatever tributes necessary to the emperor at Delhi and take some extra for administration. And so, yes, it was a public limited company. It was run for profit, made no bones about it. There's absolutely no secret that that's what they're doing in Leadenhall. The court of directors, the major shareholders, the general court of proprietors, was all shareholders and so forth. So it was a bit of a wild east at the time for Britishers going out there, because you could get rich very quickly, but very dangerous with the tropical diseases against which there was no protection. There's no quinine. Malaria was a killer. So he did very, very well in fighting the French and so on, was successful, famously, the Battle of Plassey, 1757, led to 190 years of British mastery in India. So, doing some good things, because India was in a state of anarchy, as from the death of Aurangzeb in 1707, the Mughal Empire was falling apart. The Nawabs, who were actually governors, came to be equivalent of king, stopped paying tribute, and he didn't have enough money to fund his army, his navy, and so forth. Rebellions, his writ didn't run very far, always fighting. The Mughal emperors overthrowing each other. There was no primogeniture and things like that. Heavily discriminated against the Hindus with extra taxation. Remember, the Hindus were something like 60% of the population in those days. And so it was not that there was like disinterested government or any sense of human rights in India, but there had been a long time before, the time of Ashoka. So there was chattel slavery and so forth, and obviously women had no rights, and there was sati and all sorts of barbaric practices. I know the United Kingdom practiced slavery, and that was absolutely barbaric, kidnapping people from Africa, shipping them across the Caribbean, the most inhumane conditions. It was satanically sadistic. But they weren't doing this in India, whereas Indians were enslaving I Indians at the time. So yeah, eventually the East India Company was able to bring peace and stability gradually. And obviously it's mostly Indians working for the East India Company in the army as clerks at some level. And those who work in the East India Company often had the greatest respect for Indian culture, adulated Sir William Jones, who formed a digest of Hindu and Islamic law and learned these Indian languages, often married Indian women. There was no sense of racial superiority, adopting many Indian customs and so forth. So it really enriched British cultural life. But anyway, Clive, he came back a very wealthy man, a multi-millionaire in that sense. And that's why he was elected to Parliament. He was ennobled as Lord Clive of Plassey, where he fought that determinative battle in Bengal against Siraj ud Dowla. And it was actually through Du Semon able to get much of the other side to change sides. But he got an Irish title, even though he never set foot in the Emerald Isle. Plassey's a village in County Clare, just outside Limerick. I would think it was named Plassey for him. Because he was a peer of Ireland, he was able to be elected to the House of Commons in the Parliament of the United Kingdom. But then he died in his house on Berkeley Square. Was it by suicide? Seems to have been seen as a bipolar disorder, because he was incredibly courageous, but sometimes down in the dumps and couldn't be shifted and so on. So I mean, Pitt the Elder, Prime Minister around that time, he seemed to have had the black dog as well. Probably Churchill had that same stuff at the same bipolarity. But yeah, so bringing about better governance for India. And the legal system that they follow to this day. And so he left, he went to India for two extended stays. It's such a long voyage. And he got married, had many children, and he's got lots of descendants to this day. People mainly, well, they mainly threw at him was the Bengal famine. Now, he left India in 1767, and the Bengal famine struck in 1770. Now, how could we be responsible for something that happened 3 years after he left? Considering to get a message from Calcutta, then the capital of British India, to London and get a reply took about a year and a half. Now, it's true that they did raise taxes, partly to defray the cost of the wars that they'd fought. And some was reinvested in improving roads and harbours and so forth and education, not very much. Remember, the great mass of people were illiterate in India to the late 20th century. Even at the end of the British Raj in 1947, only 20% of Indians were literate, a figure that England surpassed in the 1530s. So he wanted to make money, and he certainly did. So he's morally mixed, and the taxes shouldn't have risen. We hear about this terrible Bengal famine, and nobody disputes that people died of malnutrition and even starvation, and that is horrendous. It's hard to even perceive what it is to die of starvation. Got to remember that malnutrition was the norm throughout the world, you know, into the early 20th century. That doesn't make it a good thing. So famines happened in India anyway, like all the time. There were no censuses. We don't know what the population of Bengal was. It's really just guesswork. There were no death certificates. We don't know how many people died. We don't know what they died of. So the figures are really just made up by often anti-imperialist bigots who tried to make it as high as possible. Nobody says it was no one who died as a result. This is very debatable to the extent that the extra taxation was a contributory factor. I mean, I agree it should have been remitted. You can't really lay that at his door. Remove the statue. I mean, would that improve relations? I don't see how it would. I'm not aware of any Indian politician who said that. And by the way, there's a statue of Clive of India in India. So they would remove it straight away if that was a problem. I mean, the Republic of India doesn't have the right to dictate about public statuary in the United Kingdom. London has never attempted to tell the Indian Republic what they may and may display in their public squares. on their sovereign territory. It really is preposterous. So I agree. He's got a mixed moral record. He's a problematic figure. Was a man of his time. In the 18th century, you can't expect him to behave like a 21st century person. So that statue must remain. The government of India has never even asked for it to be removed. And so we have to remove everyone because they don't conform to 21st century norms. That therefore, in a few centuries, all our statues will be removed. Until David Cameron, no prime minister supported same-sex marriage. Does that mean they can never be honored, or no monarch can? Every monarch presided over discrimination against Jews, then against Lollards, then against Roman Catholics, then against Anglicans, and then against Roman Catholics, and against dissenters, and whatever. So it's ludicrous to say that nobody can ever be honored because they weren't, by modern standards, right on every single issue. So Clive must stand tall. Thank you for watching my channel. Make sure you subscribe on Patreon, donate PayPal, georgecallahan790@gmail.com. Keep the comments coming.